Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you for supporting independent bookstores and for supporting our author events. We really appreciate it. Tonight, it is a great pleasure to introduce Heidi Durow, who will talk about her debut novel, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. This novel won the 2008 Bellwether Prize for Best Fiction Manuscript. And this prize was given, was designed by Barbara Kingsolver. And this is what she had to say about Heidi's book. When I first envisioned the Bellwether Prize, I imagined all the best qualities of fiction, vivid language, compelling characters, and clear moral vision. Novels just like this one, Heidi Durow's breathless telling of a tale we never heard before, haunting and lovely, pitch perfect, this book could not be more timely. And Heidi just told us that this book has jumped from 35 to 17 on the indie bestseller list, so that is wonderful. Heidi is a graduate of Stanford University and they're well represented this evening, and Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and Yale Law School. She has won the Laurian Hemingway Short Story Competition, the Chapter 1 Fiction Contest, and the Roth Endowment Award, and was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. She received grants from the New York Foundation of the Arts, the American Scandinavian Foundation, and the Lois Roth Endowment, and a fellowship for emerging writers from the Jerome Foundation. She is also the co-founder and co-producer of the Mixed Roots Film and Literary Festival. So without further ado, please welcome Heidi Durow.
Jamie thought Robbie was a bird flying down below his window. He had been waiting for this bird and ran downstairs without calling to his mother, going outside, which is what his mother had told him to say, even if she didn't hear him above the din of the television that played loudly in her room. Jamie knew that his mother was not watching television. She had a new friend in there. Jamie knew the television as something that made sounds to keep the sound out. He was okay with that. The bird he had waited for had come. Of course, it didn't have to be this one, but it was. There were any number of hundreds of birds that didn't belong in the Chicago sky. There were two windows in his apartment. One faced the alley and the other the courtyard. Jamie didn't watch out the alley window anymore. The things that he'd see fly by were never birds, but garbage bags hurled out the window from higher floors. They sometimes struck the air conditioning units below, whoomp, sometimes catching there and rotting hot during the summer months. Jamie, who was really James, was named after his father, but not named Junior, because he was really the third. Jamie wanted a strong name like Steve or Brick. He had been Jamie since he was born, even though there was no way to confuse him with his father, James, a man he had met only in dreams. Jamie wanted a name with a different history. Jamie, who was really James, ran downstairs to find the bird, to identify it, to see it. He would remember what he saw. He would write it down. He would record the date on his life list, the name of another bird. In his hands, he held a book. It was the only gift he had ever asked for, but the book was not a gift. His birthday, July 23rd, came and went with no celebration and no cake and no gift. Jamie got the book from the library. When the metal detector went off, he laid on the table a pocket knife he had found in the pants draped across the bathtub, the pants of his mother's new friend. "Young man," the stout lady library security guard said.
You know you ain't supposed to be carrying this kind of thing around.
Jamie, who was really James, nodded.
I'm gonna keep this here till you come back round with your mama. She says it's okay for you to have it.
His plan worked. He left behind the pocket knife, but took with him the Peterson Field Guide to the Birds of Eastern and Central North America. He ran downstairs with the Peterson Field Guide. What is its shape? What shape are its wings? What shape is its bill? What shape is its tail? How does it behave? Does it climb trees? How does it fly? Jamie had memorized these questions from the field guide. He repeated them so much in his head they seemed to have a melody. He knew the whole topography of a bird. His favorite part of the book was the beginning and the end. Not as if the book held a story, but he loved the two sets of pictures of the bird silhouettes. Number 13 was the magpie, 25 the meadowlark, 9, well, that was the mockingbird, and 14 was the nighthawk. He was certain the silhouette of the great egret had passed his courtyard window. He ran downstairs. One day he would leave the city and find more birds, Jamie thought, as he took the stairs two by two and then slid down the sticky banister on the last three-step flight before the door. He would fill up his life list with birds he could name and call, and when he finally reached the courtyard, he saw that his bird was not a bird at all. His bird was a boy and a girl and a mother and a child. The mother, the girl, the child, they looked like they were sleeping, eyes closed, listless. The baby was still in her mother's arms, a gray sticky porridge pouring from the underside of her head. The girl was heaped on top of the boy's body, a bloody, helpless pillow, and yet there was an old mattress, doughy from rain, just 10 feet from the bird boy's right arm, which was folded like a wing beneath him. Pain moved the boy's body. His bones jutted from his wrists. His eyes were wide open. He can see me, Jamie thought. The boy seemed to have landed feet first on the sodden cement courtyard filled with garbage bags bursting with scent and refuse. The bones from the bottom of the boy's leg poked through his jeans at his thigh. He lay on the ground on his back as if he had fallen from a large, comfortable nest. It was not until the policeman came and raked through the courtyard's waste that Jamie could turn away. The policeman collected matchbooks, soda bottles, and empty brown paper bags, scraps of paper and other possible clues, a jack of clubs playing card lying on a brown stained sheet, and a ticket from Saturday's Quick Pick Lotto. Jamie was still holding his Peterson Field Guide. He had no names for what he saw.
Just say wow, thank you. So thank you guys, it's so exciting to be here. So that was a short piece from my debut novel called The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, and I want to tell you more about the book and share a couple of short excerpts with you from other chapters, but first I want to thank Tattered Cover for inviting me here. Thank you, Lisa, and this great ensemble of people you've brought together for me. I really appreciate it. And Jackie Blem, who is an early champion of my book and was spreading the word back in the day, back in the dark days of July and August when no one had heard of the girl, but Jackie had, and she spread the word on Goodreads and throughout the land, I think, which I really appreciate, so thank you. This book, it's number 17 now on the indie bestseller list, and it's really, I thank all of you. I mean, I thank my friends and family and their friends and family, and I thank the independent booksellers because that's really how the book is getting out there. There hasn't been lots of giant publicity, but people are connecting with the story, and it's word of mouth, and I really appreciate you guys sharing the story with others. I actually get a little choked up thinking about that because this is a little small book. I started it in 1997. It took me 12 years to write and get published. I was rejected
dozens of times by publishers who said, no one cares about a little half black, half Danish girl. We can't publish this book and sell it. So ha, on them. My savior, though, the one gatekeeper, and this is advice I must give to anyone who's a writer in the room, and it was advice my agent gave me. She said, you just need the one gatekeeper to say yes. That's all you need. The problem is you've got to find the gatekeeper. You've got to find that gate. I was really lucky in that my gatekeeper was Barbara Kingsolver, and she created this amazing prize called the Bellwether Prize for Literature of Social Change. It's awarded every other year to a first-time, I used to say young, but it's not young. I'm not young anymore. I like to pretend. A first-time novelist who's writing a book about issues of social change and justice. And she picked my book this year. I'm the fifth winner. I was incredibly gratified to get her call, of course. I didn't answer it, of course, because it was an unidentified number. But I did call her back, and I found out that I had won, and I cannot be more grateful. So I just wanted to read to you, I know that Lisa said what the prize was, but I wanted to say exactly what Barbara Kingsolver says about the prize. These are her words. She says, fiction has a unique capacity to bring difficult issues to a broad readership on a personal level, creating empathy in a reader's heart for the theoretical stranger. Its capacity for invoking moral and social responsibility is enormous. Throughout history, now, this is not her part, but we're making history right now by choosing the stories we want to tell, and the ones that we validate, and the ones that we choose not to tell. That's me. Okay, back to Barbara. I call her Barbara now. More about that later. Every movement toward a more peaceful and humane world has begun with those who imagined the possibilities. The Bellwether Prize seeks to support the imagination of humane possibilities. Man, I don't know if my book does that. I love that Barbara Kingsolver thinks that it does. I hope that it does that. And if this book receives any other prizes, I can tell you that the Bellwether Prize will be the most important to me going forward. Enough with the heavy stuff. Now I have jokes. The book is not just an issue novel. It's actually a coming-of-age story, and it's the story of Rachel. She survives the accident that Jamie sees. It's inspired by a real newspaper story that I read about 15 years ago. A family had an accident. I'm being a little cagey because I want you to read the book. You can find out what happens. But the real girl actually survived this accident, and the stories at the time were all about, how could we live in a world where this happens? And why? Why would this happen? Let us find culprits. And I was really interested in this girl. She lived. She had a future. She needed a story. And I wanted to give her a voice. And so that's how I started writing the book. I wanted to figure out, what did this girl do next after this amazing tragedy, after losing her family? So in the book, Rachel is 11 years old, and she's half black and half white. She's half African American and half Danish. She has blue eyes. She's about this high. No, she's a little shorter at 11. So she, and also I'm wearing heels. But so I didn't know anything about the real girl. I knew her name and I knew her age, and there was kind of an old sketchy photo of her in the newspaper story. And the truth was, I didn't want to know, because that was her own private world, but I wanted to imagine something for her. And all I could imagine was what I knew, which was being biracial and being bicultural. And so I put that into Rachel. So in my book, Rachel, after this accident, goes to live with her African American grandmother in Portland, Oregon, where, guess what? I grew up. And she is trying to come to terms with not only her grief of this past, of losing her mother, her siblings, but also trying to figure out, what is this thing that people are asking me to choose. She's grown up overseas always, and she's always thought of herself as American. And suddenly she's in a racially divided town in a black neighborhood, and people are telling her that she's got to choose. Is she black or white? And she doesn't understand what this black is and what this white is, and what does it matter, really? So I wanted to share with you guys a couple of other excerpts from the book. It's told from multiple perspectives. Obviously, you get the character Jamie, who's a witness to her accident, which I thought was very important in the writing of the book, because if something bad happens and no one sees it, then you don't know that it's actually bad. But he knows it's bad, and so I wanted to give her a witness in addition to a voice. So it's told from his perspective as well as others, the mother, a friend of the mother, and the father. But the most important to me really is Rachel, who gets a voice. She's 11 years old, and she has gone to live with her African-American grandmother and Aunt Loretta. And this is very early on in the book. It's day two, actually. And I think the only thing you need to know about this section is that the word for mom in Danish is mor. Rachel says, "In my diary, I write, this is day two, second day at Grandma's house. I wish I could go back home, home to before the summer in Chicago, back to base housing in Germany when there was me and Robbie and Moa and Pop and everything was okay. Even though there wouldn't be an Ariel, that would be okay too. Aunt Loretta makes pancakes special for me, even though she has no business in the kitchen. Two pancakes and not enough syrup is what she gives me. Syrup that makes the stain in the pancake middle gone so fast like the pancake is thirsty. I eat exactly what she gives me. Aunt Loretta eats only one pancake and Grandma none because her teeth don't set right. There is something dangerous about pancakes because Grandma watches us eat. How are you gonna catch a lizard with your backside loading you down? Grandma fusses at Aunt Loretta. I am smart and know that when she says lizard, she means husband. That is called learning the meaning from the context because Grandma says it and she touches Aunt Loretta's face at the same time. That means she's talking about being pretty and being worth something and making it count. Aunt Loretta laughs and so do I. They are happy that I am laughing. It's the first time as the new girl. I don't need a lizard, Mama. When Aunt Loretta says Mama, I think of saying Moa and how I don't get to say it anymore. I am caught in before and after time, last time things and firsts. Last time things make me sad, like the last time I called for Moa and used Danish sounds. I feel my middle fill up with sounds that no one else understands. Then they reach my throat. What if these sounds get stuck in me? I laugh harder, but the real laugh feels trapped inside, too. School is not a first-time thing. I sit in the front where I always do. I sit quietly like I am supposed to do. I raise my hand before speaking and write my name in the top right-hand corner of the paper and the date, because this is what good students do. Mrs. Anderson is homeroom and language arts. She is a black woman. I think about this and don't know why. It is something I am supposed to know but not think about. Mrs. Anderson is my first black woman teacher. It makes me go back in my mind. Mrs. Marshall, first grade favorite. Mrs. Price, second grade, not so nice. Mrs. Mamiya, third grade, beautiful. Mrs. Breedlove, fourth grade, smart. Mr. Ingalls, fifth grade, bald and deep voice. I remember they are all white. There are 15 black people in the class and 7 white people, and there's me. There's another girl who sits in the back. Her name is Carmen LaGuardia, and she has hair like mine, my same color skin, and she counts as black. I don't understand how, but she seems to know. I see people two different ways now, people who look like me and people who don't look like me. Day two becomes day three, and the next day and the next. I count each day in my diary. Each day gets a new page. Grandma thinks I am adjusting well. She says, I think you adjusting just fine. I want her to put S's on the ends of her words and not say fixin' to when she's about to do something. The kids in school say that, and I know they're not as smart as me. There is a girl who wants to beat me up. She says, you think you so cute. Her name is Tamika Washington. She says, I'm fixing to kick your ass. Sometimes she pulls my hair. In gym class, she grabbed my two braids and I said, ouch, really loud, even though I didn't mean to. And Mrs. Carr heard. She said, Tamika, and blew the whistle real loud. And Tamika said, Miss Kay, I'm just playing with her. Dang. When Mrs. Carr turned away again, that's when Tamika said it. I'm fixing to kick your ass after school. You think you're so cute with that hair. I am light-skinned. That's what the other kids say. And I talk white. I think new things when they say this. Like, there are a lot of important things I didn't know about. I think Moa didn't know either. They tell me it is bad to have ashy knees. They say, stay out of the rain so my hair doesn't go back. They say, white people don't use wash rags. And I realize now, at Grandma's, I do. They have a language I don't know, but I understand. I learn that black people don't have blue eyes. I learn that I am black. I have blue eyes. I put all these new facts into the new girl. That's Rachel. Thank you, guys. I'm so delighted. You have no idea, like, as a writer, maybe you're a writer out there, but as a writer, so long, no one cares at all what you're saying or writing, and you guys are here smiling and laughing and clapping. You have no idea what this has done for my life. Thank you. Oh, and buy the book. Or get it from your library. That's okay, too. So you can tell, obviously, that I love Rachel. But she's imperfect. She really is. She's struggling. She doesn't have answers. She has lots of questions. She's trying to fill things in. And she has all these feelings she doesn't know how to deal with at all. But she comes up with a trick. And this is her trick, she says. When something starts to feel like hurt, I put it in this imaginary bottle inside me. It's blue glass with a cork stopper. My stomach tightens and my eyeballs get hot. I put all of that inside the blue bottle. It's something you could use. Try it yourself. So I just wanted to read just one more short excerpt from the book. And then if you have questions, I'd love to entertain questions. But then after that, we're all going to have to go get a drink. So this is about 9 months later. She's at grandmother still. She's got her blue bottle trick. She's okay. You know, in that way, you're okay when you say, how are you? I'm okay. She's okay. But she's still ready to be excited about things, and it's the end of the school year, so she says, there's nothing better than June because it's the end of the school year and there's nothing but summer for weeks, except first, it's race day. It's the end of the year Olympics, and our class is Guam. Mrs. Anderson likes the way it sounds, and all the other good countries are taken. I was the fastest girl in the fifth grade. That's when I ran faster than everyone except Eric Smith. The teachers called him Eric S. We called him Fast Eric. There was also Eric K with a K. We called him Smart Eric. Sometimes when I used to run, I would think I could beat anybody, even Eric S. Sometimes I didn't think at all, just ran, and it felt good. I don't know if I can beat anyone here. Today is race day, and Tamika Washington looks at me. She been looking at me. That means she's looking at me now and started a long time ago. But since I cut my hair, Tamika Washington don't be minding me no more. Aunt Loretta says Tamika is just jealous because her hair won't grow. But now my hair is shorter than Tamika's, and she calls me Afro Head because my hair curls all up any way it wants, and hers is straight and flat. I don't understand why Tamika is looking at me like that. Tamika gets the other girls to look at me like that. She has lots of friends, Keisha, Tanya, Sierra, and even Carmen LaGuardia. I have one girlfriend and a boyfriend, but my friend is white and my boyfriend is secret. I have no black friends. Black girls don't seem to like me. Maybe there is something dangerous about me. Aunt Loretta says there isn't. Good students like me aren't always going to be popular with their peers. Those are her exact words. I want to be a good student. I know how to do that. I think being a good student will help me in the long run. I think of the long run, the way that Aunt Loretta says it. Me running down the sidewalk past the old German dairy store and Emmanuel Hospital, across the Fremont Bridge and through the hills which must lead to somewhere. Aunt Loretta wishes she had thought about the long run and had studied more, gotten a better job and a husband different than Uncle Nathan that wasn't so funny and didn't have a special kind of cancer for men like him. You can get real sad later if you don't think about the long run, like open arms that will hold you. The race starts. I run faster than Tamika, and maybe I'm going as fast as Eric Eswood. I run and run harder, and I cross the finish line first. The medal ceremony is in the middle of the football field, so everyone can see, and I go to the center of the field. It is Carmen LaGuardia, the student class president, who gives me the blue ribbon and medal I will wear home that afternoon. I imagine how she will put the blue ribbon with the golden saucer-sized medallion around my neck, gently, gently, then smooth the front of my shirt with a long, soft stroke. She will take my hand and raise it in victory, and everyone will see that the beautiful Carmen LaGuardia is just like me. She is no longer one of the 15, and I will no longer count myself as one. These are the first words she says to me.
Girl, you got them boys panting with your titties all hanging out like that. Don't you try to steal my man with those.
Tamika is second place and bends at the waist laughing. She is still bent over when Carmen LaGuardia puts the smaller medallion around her neck and then gives her a high five. I don't cry. I have the blue bottle. I make resolutions. I turn 12 next month. It's day 223. I'm the new girl. I must be the new girl. I will fill myself with the color blue.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.